Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Roundtable and to our book pick segment. We do it a little bit earlier today because we want to get it in and because we will have our lockbox push coming up at 11:30 this morning. So let me introduce the booksellers and we will get underway. We have a full house today. Couldn't be more excited to have all of these brilliant minds in one room. Connie Brooks and Heather Boyne from Battenkill Books in Cambridge, New York. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
It's really wonderful to have you here. Sharon Weinberg and Amy Zimmerman from Chatham Bookstore in Chatham, New York. Good morning, Sharon and Amy.
Good morning.
Wonderful to have you here. Thank you and welcome all. I will give information at the end on where you can find the book picks because, you know, you always ask. WAMC.org/roundtable is our website. I'll give the websites for the stores coming up in just a moment. Connie Brooks, let us begin with you.
Sure thing. So I start with the novel called The Children by Melissa Albert. This is Albert's adult debut. She has written young adult up to this point, and this was my first time reading her. And in our story, we have Guinevere and Ennis Sharp, and they live what to the outside world looks like an ideal childhood. They are the daughter and son of a legendary children's book author and her eccentric actor-artist husband. They are essentially allowed to free range through their childhood in a bucolic and very isolated Vermont farmhouse with only occasional incursions of outside guests. The reality is far more complicated, however. Yes, on the one hand, they are incredibly inventive and intelligent children, and they have a very close sibling bond. On the other hand, as we learn, their mother is impossibly remote, and their father struggles in his wife's outsized shadow. Edith's first fantasy novel about a legendary realm called the Ninth City becomes a runaway bestseller, and her subsequent books receive a Harry Potter-level popularity. And from the beginning, Edith has named her two main protagonists after her children. And so the cult-like following that her books achieve brings a sort of unearned, unwanted fame to the real-life Guinevere and Ennis. Now we fast forward to their adulthood. The parents have died. The sister kind of manages the literary estate, but she's estranged from her brother at this point. He's a world-famous artist, and she learns that he is about to open a forthcoming exhibit, which is titled simply Mother. So if you sense a reckoning coming, you're not wrong. And I just love this book for its shimmering foreboding. And, I mean, your heart races reading it in the best possible way.
Shimmering and foreboding. Certainly a mood of the room. Okay. Amy.
Oh, I'm going to pass it actually to Sharon.
Sharon.
Okay. All right. Talk about foreboding. My book, which comes out today, is called Liar's Kingdom, How to Stop Trump's Deceit and Save America by Andrew Weissman. So Andrew is an NYU law school professor, a legal analyst on MSN Now, and he's co-host of the podcast Main Justice. But the reason why you probably know him is because he served as a lead prosecutor in Mr. Mueller's special counsel's office, which has earned him a prominent place on Trump's enemies list. This is Andrew's third book, and it should be mandatory reading for concerned citizens trying to understand our current political situation. It's a short, incisive answer to the question of what to do about leaders who lie. He points out that we have civil and criminal remedies for people who lie to other people, to banks, to institutions, the government. People go to jail for lying. But there are no legal consequences for politicians who lie. And here Weissman pulls no punches, detailing some of the most egregious lies promulgated by the Trump administration, most notably, of course, the insistence that the 2020 election was stolen. So Weissman's proposal is a new law, the Truth in Elections Act, as well as other potential legal solutions. Okay, I hope I haven't lost people. It's about law, but it's a really clear, understandable treatise. It's short, it's to the point, it's aimed at the general public. If you want a deeper dive, there are many scholarly footnotes, but they are in the back. They don't even interrupt the flow. We ran a pre-order campaign and were impressed by the number of people who are anxiously concerned about the current state of our democracy. The book, as I said, comes out today. We are anticipating a lively debate that hopefully will inspire some action.
Liar's Kingdom is the name of the book by Andrew Weissman. Heather.
All right. My book is Newcomers, The Story of Anthony and Gretia and the Founding of New York by Alan McHale. Alan McHale is the Chase Family Professor of History at Yale University. Almost 400 years ago, a poor immigrant couple named Anthony Janssen Vanselay and Gretia Ranier arrived in Dutch New Amsterdam from Europe in search of a better life. They met and married in the Netherlands just before setting sail in 1629. Gretia was a widower in her 20s. She was a member of the Dutch Reformed Church, a maid, and had been a sex worker. Anthony Janssen Vanselay, his name meaning Anthony, Jan's son from Salé in Morocco, emigrated around 1625 to Amsterdam. He would have been 17 or 18 years old. His history is harder to pin down. He might have been born in Spain and enslaved by a Dutch sailor who took him captive in North Africa, or maybe he was a pirate. Whether he was a Muslim or simply was perceived as being Muslim, he acquired the nickname of Anthony the Turk. Anti-Muslim sentiment and the social stigma associated with Gretia's past profession followed the couple to New Amsterdam. And amid legal and social troubles in their new hometown, in 1639, they were banished to the outskirts of the town to what is now Brooklyn. The couple was among the first non-Indigenous settlers in that area. They raised a family, acquired property, and when Gretia died in 1669, Anthony returns to the now English Manhattan and becomes not only one of the richest men in 17th century New York, but the patriarch of an all-American family that included the Vanderbilts and President Warren G. Harding. Professor McHale does not shy away from admitting that some records are thin, but his research is thorough and sound, filling in genealogical details that were unknown. He is transparent that the couple helped to capture native land and that Anthony became a contractual master that forced men into a type of indentured servitude. Their stories are complicated and not sanitized, and sometimes that's why we don't hear about these early settlers. After digging in the many archives, McHale points out that historians often overlook the hustlers, sexually opened, racially ambiguous, and otherwise in-between figures. The notes are top-notch, and again, the research is a thing of beauty. As we get better interpreting and accessing records, the story of the United States becomes more complete and reflects the diversity that our country is built on. This book opens the door so that those ancestors can be celebrated.
All right. And the name of the book is?
Newcomers.
The Story of Anthony and?
Gretia.
And the Founding of New York. Oh, wonderful. All right. Hi, Amy.
I'll take that. So I am very excited to recommend How Queer Bookshops Changed the World by A.J. West, which was published earlier this month. I consider myself to be pretty well-versed in both queer and literary history, but I was utterly put to shame by this book, which introduced me to so many new queer authors and works of literature, as well as iconic bookstores and booksellers who, in my biased opinion, should really be household names. It turns out that tracing the advent and evolution of the queer bookstore unearths all sorts of overlapping histories. There's the history of queerness in the West, as it morphed from a criminal activity or mental disorder that a person could be accused of to an identity that one might proudly claim. Then there's the symbiotic evolution of queer literature, which began as purely erotica and then responded to these sociocultural shifts by becoming more multifaceted, literary, and legitimate. Another thread here is the legal history of censorship and quote-unquote obscene materials. This book shows how booksellers were on the front lines of all of these connected movements, pressuring publishers into backing queer literature, fighting for free speech and the right to put books into the hands of those who need them the most, and building spaces where queer people could come to safely discover themselves and each other. This might sound like a lot of ground, but author A.J. West briskly ushers readers through the decades, stopping to point out only the most relevant protests and legal cases, as well as the most exciting bookstores and colorful characters. And it is the characters here, the weird and fallible and fearless booksellers, that will stay with you. I was particularly enchanted by Craig Rodwell, a former Christian Scientist turned ballet dancer who dated Harvey Milk before he went on to open the Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookshop in New York City. This was one of the first queer bookstores in the world, and Rodwell and his staff frequently watched customers lingering outside of the doors for hours, afraid to potentially out themselves by walking in. Naturally, this safe space became a hub for political activism, with Rodwell himself organizing countless rallies and protests. I found myself tearing up at a scene in the book where Rodwell, in the middle of the mayhem of the Stonewall riots, begins a chant of gay power that catches on in the face of arrests and police violence, which is rare for introverts like us booksellers. In the following days, he tirelessly appealed to media outlets to cover the riots before taking matters into his own hands by preparing and distributing a zine. Again, peak bookseller behavior. That story and this whole book is such an important reminder that our work as booksellers has always been political, long before this current wave of book banning and censorship. And it's an honor to follow in the footsteps of all of the radical activists and community builders who have slung books before us.
How Queer Bookshops Changed the World by A.J. West. Connie.
All right. I turn to a memoir this time, and I have The Patient Weight of the Stones, Time and Memory in Lunigiana by Antonio Romani and co-translated by Martha Cooley. Romani is newly a homeowner in rural Italy, and he finds himself reconstructing an ancient stone wall. The wall and the home are in a small terraced village that lies in the shadow of an old castle in the far northern tip of Tuscany. The wall has bowed outward, succumbing to the pressures of time and gravity, and it threatens to give way entirely if not reconstructed. The art of reconstruction requires dismantling the dry masonry, removing insidious weeds and brambles, and relaying the stones without the benefit of mortar to keep the whole thing together. Instead, the stonemason must weigh each stone, examine their shape and size, and knit the whole wall back into one piece. The proximity to the land, combined with the back-breaking labor, unlocks something of Romani's past, and his memories pour forth. And the laying of the stones becomes a beautiful metaphor for navigating grief and mortality in this beautiful memoir. This is the English translation. It will be published in 2 weeks by Galpon Press. And we're looking forward to having Antonio and his wife and co-translator, Martha Cooley, with us on Friday, June 5th at 6 o'clock to talk about the book.
That is very cool. The Patient Weight of the Stones by Antonio Romani. Wonderful. All right. Hi, Sharon.
Okay. The Family Man, Blood and Betrayal in the House of Murdoch by James Lasdin is an incredibly well-timed account of the 2023 murder of Maggie and Paul Murdoch. The South Carolina murder trial of Alec Murdoch, the husband slash father of the victims, featured sordid accounts of opiate drug abuse, massive fraud, fake suicides, suspicious accidents, and levels of betrayal and corruption that seemed especially evil, steeped as they were in an insular society that prided itself on its good old boy values. James Lasdin, the author, is a New York Times and New Yorker author based in Brooklyn, and he approaches this complicated material with the curiosity of an outsider, genuinely trying to understand the multi-generational personalities behind the story. He tries very hard to explain how Alec Murdoch, an extremely privileged person, could be brought to the point where murdering his family seemed like a smart way to extricate himself from an increasingly untenable position. He goes beyond the easy sociopath explanation, but also admits to a level of incomprehension. What makes this book particularly relevant is that Lasdin managed to anticipate the bombshell legal decision of last week, bombshell for people like me who really follow this
right.
stuff, that overturned the conviction on various grounds, including jury tampering. And if you read it now, I mean, he really is prescient. He figures it out. Highly recommend.
Yes. All good stuff. We had James on last week, and if you want to hear our interview, you can listen to that online. And then that was on Tuesday. Then the bombshell came on Wednesday. And then we had him back on Thursday. There's an update to as well, and you can hear all that online. It's quite fascinating, as is the book, The Family Man, Blood and Betrayal in the House of Murdoch. All right.
All right. My next book is American Rambler, Walking the Trail of Johnny Appleseed by Isaac Fitzgerald. Mr. Fitzgerald's first book was the critically acclaimed 2022 memoir, Dirtbag Massachusetts, A Confessional. An American rambler, he decides to reconnect with his childhood wanderlust by setting off on a pilgrimage to walk the Johnny Appleseed Trail from Massachusetts to Indiana. Isaac soon discovers that rather than it being an actual trail, his journey will consist of driving, sailing, and hiking from memorial marker to commemorative venues. On his way, he weaves his telling of the Appleseed story, his own memories, and his commentary of current events into each chapter. He has one foot in a more macho tattooed bar culture, and while also having his other foot in a more nuanced and progressive worldview. And this makes it an enjoyable book for almost everyone. There is love and profound loss, which he handles honestly. There is a little drama, much humor, and a lot of humanity. You're taking the journey with him. I can imagine that on audio, this book would be wonderful to listen to on your vacation. It feels real and current and not overly political, the type of book that many of our readers say that they are looking for. I imagine it will be the hit of the summer at our store.
That is very cool. It's getting wonderful, wonderful praise, well-deserved. The name of the book is American Rambler, Walking the Trail of Johnny Appleseed.
Okay, it's me up again. I'm going with fiction this time.
Okay.
All right, so this, following on Heather's recommendation, this is also a great summer book. This is called A Perfect Hand by Iolette Waldman. One of our best customers and a good friend of mine is a high-powered lawyer who has very specific tastes. She comes into the store and she only wants to read happy novels with no death, sickness, or other bad things, but also they have to be smart.
Good luck. All right.
I spend a lot of time thinking about what's going to work for this person who I will not name. And by the way, I showed her this and she started editing it. That's the kind of person she is. I'm really looking forward to introducing her to A Perfect Hand by Iolette Waldman. This book is a joy to read. It's an amusing take on the classic Regency romance. We have the scrappy heroine, Alice, currently serving as lady's maid to the frivolous entitled Lady Jemima. Alice falls in love with Charlie, who is valet to Nigel, a hypochondriac gull viscount? Not a word I say often. Alice and Charlie scheme to bring their employers together so that the two young lovers can continue their own romance. It's fun and light. Alice has a biting wit, and her take on the complicated British class system is both amusing and devastating. We think we're heading towards the requisite happy ending when the novel takes a surprising and interesting turn. Alice is introduced to the suffrage movement, and all of a sudden her narrow world opens up to new and exciting and dangerous possibilities. It's a satisfying ending, even if the happy ending isn't exactly what we expected.
All right. Good stuff there as well. And the name of the book is A Perfect Hand. Connie.
All right. My next one is
a two-minute warning for everybody. Yes.
Mercy Hill by Hannah Thurman. So this is a novel. And Mercy Hill gives off gothic vibes without being at all supernatural. And another book that I kept bringing to mind when I was reading Mercy Hill was The Virgin Suicides, just if anyone has that as...
Jeffrey Eugenides.
Yes, such a good book.
Why isn't he writing right now?
I don't know.
Maybe he is, but...
Yeah,
he wrote something about knowing Robert Kennedy Jr. Brown.
Oh, yeah, that was a
Yeah, right. We need his book.
Colin Jeff.
Well, the similarities are, you know, as I say, it's kind of more of a vibe. And in Mercy Hill, there are four sisters, JJ, Caro, Mimi, and Denise. And they live on the grounds of a sprawling mental hospital complex with their mother and father. The timing of the story is important because it takes place in the late 90s and early 2000s, when mental hospitals across the country were facing closure and a vastly changing landscape of mental health care. Their mother, head of the hospital, is ruthless in her single pursuit to keep the hospital open at all costs. Everyone in her orbit is pulled into her singular goal, and it's a very clear expectation that the four daughters will first volunteer at the hospital, then go to medical school, and then return to Mercy Hill to help their mother run it, which sounds perfectly reasonable, right? Of course, the financial pressures facing the hospital mount, but so too the individuality of these four young women. And the sisters, one by one, follow very different paths from the one that their mother imagined, until we have just one daughter, the youngest, Denise, our narrator, left at home and feeling the brunt of her mother's will. There's real nuance to this story. Obviously, Thurman has a deep understanding of those times and changes in mental health at a time in this country. But also the characters are vividly drawn and I found very memorable.
All right. In our very limited time, does anybody want to mention any other events or anything happening?
Yeah, I would just say that much like WAMC, we are renovating. We are actually expanding. So stay in touch. Follow us on Instagram to learn more about that. Also, from our pre-order campaign, we do have signed copies of Andrew Weissman's Liar's Kingdom. So reach out if you're interested in grabbing one of those.
Wonderful. Connie, you mentioned one event. You have anything else you want to mention?
Gosh, no. That's the one that's coming up next. And I can't look beyond that event.
I don't blame you. No reason you should. ChathamBookstore.IndieLight.org and BattenKillBooks.com for more information. We will continue our conversation after this.